WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Milt Gabler has been a very important figure in jazz because of his shop and his Commodore record label, for which he produced new sessions and reissued earlier recordings. He was about the first person to create reissues and to create a market for them. He also ran a number of jazz concert series. In 1926, when he was a teenager, he started working in his father's shop, the Commodore Radio Shop at 136 East 42nd Street, opposite the Chrysler Building and diagonally across from the Hotel Commodore. Well, Milt Gabler turned the radio shop into the Commodore Record Shop. It became the gathering place for musicians, jazz fans, and writers. With the success of this shop, he opened a second on 52nd Street, which had become the place to hear music. Gabler also formed a record label, the Commodore Record Label. He recorded his own sessions with musicians and reissued musicians' earlier work. Commodore featured recordings of Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Chew Berry, Ben Webster, Jelly Roll Morton, among others. It was Milt Gabler who recorded Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, which her own record company did not really want to record because of the racial overtones of the lyrics. Gabler also organized, and this was in 1935, the United Hot Clubs of America. This led to Gabler's organizing concerts and jam sessions where musicians ranging from Eddie Condon to Ben Webster were invited to play. When Jack Capp asked Gabler to produce reissue records at Decca, he agreed to do it on a part-time basis. Well, he ended up staying with Decca for about 30 years. Decca became a part of MCA Records. Milt Gabler kept up the Commodore label and kept the Commodore Music Shop open until 1958, when chain store competition and discount record stores made it difficult to keep open. Now, by the way, I've told you about half of his career, the jazz half. Now, there's another half in pop music, like the lyrics he wrote to tunes like Choo 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 Boogie and the 21 records that he produced that sold over a million copies, including Rock Around the Clock. Well, Milt Gabler, it's a great, great pleasure to have you here this afternoon. I want to give you a very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
was embraceable, you. One of the Commodore recorded sessions, recorded by my guest, Milt Gabler, who's joining us this afternoon. Some of the Commodore sessions are going to be reissued under the auspices of Columbia Special Products very shortly, which is good news. Let's get back to talking about the record shop. What were some of the qualities, do you think, about the shop that made it the kind of legend that it has become now?
Well, there have been stories about the shop, but personally, I have been told why it was such a place to hang out by reading articles that were written about the shop, because as I was doing it, I didn't realize it. But I like to talk about jazz music, and so did my customers. And I would think nothing of taking off You're Driving Me Crazy by Guy Lombardo, even though I love Guy Lombardo. I recorded him for many years. I understood what he was putting down. That's what he wanted to do. So, and he was a dear friend of Louis Armstrong, so he's a good man. But the point was, I would take off a pop record. Let's say that was the year that came out. And I would wait. We didn't have booths in the beginning. I would take the record. The only turntable we had was the one that played up over the door, speaker in the door. And we would put on a Duke Ellington record or a Fletcher Henderson record or a Jack Bland Rhythm Maker record, and we would discuss them. It was a place to hang out in, and never put pressure on anybody to buy a record. Sometimes kids would come in from colleges, we were right across from Grand Central Station, and we would get all the kids from New England, a lot of universities up there. We'd get people in from Princeton, New Jersey, and they were all young people that loved jazz music. And if I thought they were spending more than their allowance or something, I would say, look, only buy two records this week. This one will be here when you come back another week. And that's the way Commodore was. The great thing about the store was there was no pressure, and I tried to keep every record made. That's why I reissued records. It used to get me angry when a record would become discontinued, whether it was a jazz record or a show tune. You know, by a singer from one of the Broadway shows. Of course, a lot of those things don't sell enough, and years later when I worked for a big record company, I realized why they were cut out. But when I was a dealer, I used to get upset because I had a special clientele, and they would look for the good things. I remember Frank Norris coming in. Frank Norris was a writer for Town and Country. And he came in after the show Jubilee opened, and he walked in. I used to sell sheet music, too, and I had all the show tunes lined up in those metal racks. And if a show had eight songs, it took eight places in the rack. And he came in, and of course, being a new show, I had that music displayed. And he took out a copy of Begin to Begin, and he said, "This is going to be one of the greatest tunes ever written, Cole Porter's Begin to Begin." And it was a begin, like a Latin tune. Latin music was getting popular then, and in fact, RCA Victor, I guess it was RCA at that point, 1933, they made it by Xavier Cugat. And it's as a begin, you know, and years later became Artie Shore and Commodore's Eddie Haywood, great record. And it's one of the top tunes of the world today. But Frank Norris knew about it after he saw the show, the only man that came in.
Who were some of your favorite customers?
Alec Wilder used to come in. Hoagie Carmichael used to come in. Johnny Mercer used to come in. Those were writers. Even great country and western artists later. Tex Ritter used to come in. He had a show on WHN in New York, Cowboy Tom's Roundup, and he lived in Tudor City. And I was the only store that had country and western records. We call them hillbilly records then. And he came in one day. I didn't know who he was. And he asked for, the title one, Rye Whiskey. He had made a record on White Label Vocalion, a 35-cent record. And I didn't have a lot of country and western records. A lot weren't made. And he asked for his record of Rye Whiskey, and I had it. because, as I said, it was a library-type record shop. If it had a number and came out, I had it. Even the classical records. But I didn't sell many classical. That's how I got into jazz, really, mentioning classical. We had a dinky little 9-foot-2-inch record shop that sold piano rolls and sheet music and still had radio stuff. The classical records, which was big ticket merchandise, were sold by the Gramophone Shop and Land Days that were on the other side of 42nd Street and Liberty Music Shop and Haynes Griffin, if you remember those old stores in New York. And they were real close to me. And I couldn't compete with them. I didn't have a carpet on the floor, and I wasn't that kind of a guy. And not that I didn't like good, serious music, it's just that I couldn't sell it. I said, what can I sell that the other fellas are throwing away? And it wound up being the music I loved, jazz. I said, nobody, when people come to me and they find a record by Louis, or Duke, they said, God, I haven't been able to get this anywhere in New York. So I said, I better specialize in jazz records because they're just throwing that business away. And this is a figure I used. I said, if only 2% of all the records sold in the United States are jazz, and I sold 1.5% or 75% of that 2%, I would do enough business to keep my doors open. And that was the theory I used as a young guy in high school to go in for jazz records. Because first of all, I loved it. And secondly, nobody else wanted it. Then I had to create an audience for it. So we had jazz concerts. We reissued records. We first people in the world to put the names of the musicians on a 78 RPM label, who played on them, the date it was made. We made mistakes on some of the first records, but that's what we started, and I'm proud of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Milt Gabler. We're talking about his Commodore record shop and the Commodore record label. Let's take a pause from our conversation and listen to another one of the sessions that you recorded. And this is a very exciting one, one with Billie Holiday. And we're going to hear her recording of Strange Fruit. And there's an interesting story that accompanies this recording, which I'd like you to tell us about.
You want to hear it before the record?
Yeah.
Well, I already had my store on 52nd Street at that point. We didn't do a lot of business there because it was on a side street in the middle of the block, and the street only came alive at night when the nightclub was open, the jazz clubs. And then I soon found out that people, when they're going around club jumping, didn't want to carry breakable 78 RPM records in a paper bag with a paper handle. And it just was a great address to mail records from it for me to enjoy myself. Billy came in one afternoon. Columbia was only two blocks away, block and a half away, really. And she had a sad look on her face, and I asked her what the trouble was, and she said the company, she was on the Vocalion label, wouldn't record Strange Fruit. And obviously it was the first great protest song ever written, and it was based on Lewis Allen's poem, anti-lynching poem, and it was a beautiful poem, and he set it to music, and she had been singing it at the Cafe Society downtown with Frankie Newton's band, and the company was afraid to record it. Obviously, they probably felt that the dealers in the lower regions of the USA might boycott them for recording it or something. Anyway, they didn't take the chance, and I said, Billy, if you can get permission from Columbia to record the song for Commodore, I'll make it immediately. I'll make it tomorrow. And the next day she came back in and said she had gotten permission.
Who gave the permission? Was it John Hammond?
Well, I always felt that if John didn't have the authority to give a permission, he would be all for a recording of that song, and that he spoke to one of the brass and said, look, it's a little record label, it don't mean anything, let her record it for Commodore. And that was it was the first big hit record, what you might call hit record, that I ever made, but it was a hit Strange Fruit got all the attention in the press, but it was a hit for the other side, which was Fine and Mellow, a blues that we cooked up for the session.
Okay, well, let's hear Strange Fruit now, as recorded for Commodore Records with Billie Holiday. Holiday singing Strange Fruit. The record that we heard was produced for Commodore Records, the record label of my guest, Milt Gabler. What was it like to work with Billie Holiday? What were your impressions of
her? Well, the years when I worked with her, she was a great artist. There are certain artists that you record through the years that you call one-take artists. They don't have to stay there and sing the song six or seven times until it gets so tired it has no life to it any longer. Billie, if the band was balanced, could get a recording in on one take, two the most. And Bing Crosby was that way, and Louie was that way once he got the words set the way he wanted to do them. Ella Fitzgerald was that way. Peggy Lee was that. All the great ones are that way. They know the way they want to do a song, and they're not experimenting. They're great artists. So she was a pleasure to work with until years later when she got ill. I had her after the Commodore. This first Commodore session was 1939. Of course, I borrowed her from Columbia. So she went back to Columbia, and this record became a big hit. And by letting me record Billie, I created a star for them. And she started selling jukeboxes and everything.
You recorded her again later in her career.
Well, later when the war came and they let her go. And, oh no, there was a recording ban. In 1943, there was a recording ban for about a year and a half, and they let her contract expire, evidently, because she came to me. I was working for Decca in 1943. I joined them in 41. And she said, "Milt, I want to record for you again. I was lucky with you, and Volcanion are okay," I think she was then. "Nothing is happening." She did records with Teddy Wilson, and she made her own records. And I want to come with you because you understand me, and it was lucky. And I said, fine. I was happy to get her back. But first I did two more Commodore sessions so that I could have an LP. And she was working with Eddie Haywood, and we'll play one of those later. But they were at the Cafe Society downtown. He was a great pianist and arranger. He had just done Begin the Begin with his little band. And I went to Joe Glazer, Billy's manager, and I paid her way over what I pay anybody what she was making at Columbia. And I did the two more sessions so that I would have... I did three more sessions because I have 16 Billie Holiday sides in the Commodore catalog. And then one day I used to always stop into Jimmy Ryan's to say hello and have a drink. And there was a club next door. Forget the name of it. That's not important. I had my drink and Billy went on next door and I went into the room and she was singing Lover Man. And I said, my God, that's a natural smash hit. I don't know if you know what a natural hit is. During the year when you're a record producer, an A&R man working for a record company, if you find two natural hits in one year, a natural hit is a song that you almost cannot destroy. And no matter who you give it to, it becomes a hit. If you sing it going up in the elevator man says, gee, that's a great tune, you know, that's a natural. So I walk in and she's singing Lover Man, and anybody would know that's a hit. So I said, God, I got to record that immediately before someone steals it from her, some other singer. So I said, Billy, we got to record that song. And then I went home and I couldn't sleep. I said, if I do it for Commodore, it's going to become a hit. And if it's a hit, Jack Capp will fire me. Because I had to make a decision when I did a jazz record. He didn't care. But I was allowed to make Commodore records while I worked for this commercial company. And I said, that's a commercial hit, even though it's Billie Holiday. So I went up to Jack Capp and I said, I want to record Billie Holiday. I want to give her a contract. He says, whatever you say, Milt. I said, we got a smash hit. And I took her away from Commodore because I was afraid the song was going to be a hit. And it became a standard immediately. And the first time and only argument I ever had with Billy, he asked me if I got along with her. She insisted on using strings on that record. She was the first black artist to record with strings that I know of. Now, I know in Downbeat and on the street and all, they'd be screaming that I used strings with Billie Holiday. They wanted a jazz group behind her. And I could see, because this was a kind of a pop tune. When I recorded with Eddie Haywood, those were arranged, the slow tunes. Even though it was 6 men, it sounded like a commercial record with his pretty fills and things. But this was going to be a larger orchestra, so we got Tutti Camerata. It was a great arranger, and we got the strings for a big string section, 5 strings. And I think I had Joe Guy playing trumpet a legato on it. And of course it's a ballad, so it didn't have much to do with jazz. It was the content of the song.
Why did she want the strings? Did she tell you? Did you think it would
just
sell
play
more?
Pretty.
Or
no.
She thought it would be prettier.
She liked it pretty.
That's something that's always difficult for me to understand, since I always feel... That in the typical pop string arrangement backing up a jazz singer, that they're very inhibited and restricted.
Yeah,
by
but
that
the strings don't do anything but just play like you might have a reed section. But they sound pretty to her ears. She and Lester Young and she were very much like that. Like they like poetic, pretty things. In fact, when you go through Billie's career, she might have done a lot of unimportant torch songs, but she lent herself to them, and she sang for losers. And that's why they loved her in the clubs. You could sit there and drink and have had an argument with your girlfriend or boyfriend and broken up a great romance, and she would sing right at you. And that was her thing. And she could swing, but she loved ballads.
So how did those records sell, the ones with strings that you produced for Decca, afraid that they'd become a
terrific.
Hit?
Uh-huh. And I had writers write for her. We wrote things like Good Morning Heartache, Don't Explain. And I remember, it wasn't the Decca period, but after I did Strange Fruit and Find a Mellow, she came to me. She used to write with a fellow named Arthur Herzog. And she had come up, I'm sure it's her idea, she had come up with God Bless the Child. She came into the store with me with the words written on a piece of paper, How Do You Like It, Milt? And I guess he put a tune to it and helped her with the words too. But to me, that was her idea, because the lyric in that is Billy. And he made it work as a song. And I looked at that and I said, that's a natural. I couldn't record it. She was a vocalion, an okay artist. But from Love a Man on, she was a Decca artist up until about 1949.
Well, let's hear another one of the recordings that you did record with her for Commodore.
Yeah, this is one with Eddie Haywood's band.
Was this your choice for her to sing, or did she choose it?
Well, we get together, and I try to do tunes that she hadn't made recently on vocalion or with Teddy, and this evidently at that time was a standard that she liked that she hadn't cut.
This is a tune you probably know, I'll Get By. Holiday singing I'll Get By as recorded for Commodore Records. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Milt Gabler, whose Commodore Record Shop and Commodore Record Label are really legends of jazz. He also has been, worked with MCA and Decca Records for about 30 years, producing a lot of pop records as well as the jazz that he produced with Commodore. I asked you earlier, what you thought of your role as producer when you started, producing records for your Commodore record label, and you looked at me and you said, we didn't even have words like producer then. There was no such thing as an A&R man. We hadn't invented that term yet. But what was your attitude as far as your own role within the sessions that you were working on?
Well, I once wrote a piece on it, and the word I used was catalyst. And that's really what an A&R man is, and my definition. Gee, I wish I had. I conceived a definition for what I did. And it's a thing where you put an artist and a song and an arranger and a group of musicians and capable engineers in a studio, and you mix it all together, and you try and get a record that lives, a great record lives, you know, and it's there for all time, just like film. And you have to have it played the way you want and get them to do what you want them to do, the way you conceive the song, and you must never let them know that you're doing it. It's their song and their hit, and all you do is give birth to it, and it's always theirs.
So you have something in your mind that you wanted to get put on record, but you didn't want to make your own presence felt too strongly. You tried to.
Well, I didn't realize it. This is years later. I conceived this definition of it because I made records, produced records later for 25 years. Decca hired me because of the good Commodores I made, and to reissue old Brunswick and Vocalion records, which I got them to buy, and then hire me to reissue them for them, Later, they realized what I knew about pop music and recording people, and I became the most prolific producer they had. But you add a touch of yourself to it. You must.
You've done a number of takes for some of the records that you've produced. When the musicians got done playing a tune, if you didn't think it was quite right, if you thought that they could really do it better, how many times would you let yourself do that and ask them to do it again before... Or did you always wait till you felt, oh, that's it, that is a take?
You always try to get it on the first take, because that's always the best. Or the second even may be better than the first. But first you run the tune down. We had to do that in those days because you cut on wax or acetate, and you were limited as to playing time. The average 10-inch record ran 2:50 to 3 minutes and 15 or 20 seconds. And that's why I did the first long Commodore jazz concert. Jam session number 3 was Four Sides of a Good Man is Hard to Find on 12-inch. I wanted to get a long performance like they would do in a nightclub, but it's one of our famous recordings. But there was no tape, and I had to stop each time and start again on this part 2. Anyway, you're limited by the amount of playing time. So you run it down, time a chorus. Say it runs 40 seconds. You say, well, we'll get 40, we'll get 3 choruses on it. Then you say, first chorus, you play the tune. Second chorus, you give it to Pee-wee, then to Bobby, then to Jeff Stacy. Then you go back to the ensemble or a half a chorus out. You have to time it to fit on the record. Some good takes are lost because it runs too long. But you run it down, and when you use musicians like we used on Commodore, they're all such pros, you know. It's like a great football team or a great basketball team. They know what they're all doing, and often if we picked out the songs, Eddie and I, they would play them in the room so they'd get real familiar with them. And when they came to the session on Saturday, they would be ready. You'd only need one or two takes.
What would you have for the musicians? What kind of environment did you try to, create for them?
Well, I knew most of them liked to drink, so I would have a couple of bottles on a date, but I wouldn't open them until we had 2 numbers done.
Uh-huh.
And because, you know, you'd want them to get the 4 songs in.
We're going to hear another record that you produced for Commodore with Coleman Hawkins.
Yeah, it's good. Roy Eldridge on it, so let's play I Surrender, Dear.
¶¶
Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge. By the way, the piano that you heard, that was Benny Carter. Milt Gabler was saying as we were listening to it that Benny Carter, who's known mostly for his alto playing and trumpet playing, also played piano, and that was him featured on this session. My guest is Milt Gabler. We're talking about his Commodore record label and the Commodore record shop that he ran up till about 1958 in Manhattan. You've been in jazz for a long time and have seen many different styles come and go and many different fads and fashions in jazz become marketable and suddenly unmarketable. Mm-hmm. You have been a promoter of jazz recordings. You've worked for a big company and for your own independent small Commodore label. What do you think now about the amount of muscle that record companies are putting into jazz?
Well, some of them seem to be putting a lot of muscle into it. I don't know if the records are selling as much as the excitement created in the press about jazz coming back and all, and whether it will pay off dollar-wise for the major companies. It seems that independent companies with a low overhead can handle jazz better than the big companies because if they don't get a large enough sale, they tend to get off of it fast, the same as they would a pop record, and first thing you know, they're frowning at the jazz artist, and the jazz artist gets unhappy, and it hasn't changed much in all of the years. There is a larger market, more young people are getting into it, and with the rock and fusion jazz, I don't personally like it as much as the mainstream and traditional and some of the contemporary artists. But because to me it's a hybrid, really. It's a way to try and get jazz people to sell more by putting rock behind them, you know. And to me, I just like that beautiful, tight rhythm, you know.
Now, a lot of people think that if the record companies just paid a little more attention to the jazz musicians and put a little more push and a little bit more advertising money into their work, that jazz would sell a lot more, would reach a wider audience, and would kind of gain popularity, since there's this incredible syndrome, you know, in music. Like, what's played on the radio is what's sold is what's played.
Well,
and it's this huge self-perpetuating cycle,
right.
But you've got to put that kind of, the way the record industry is now, you've got to put that money and muscle in somewhere to start that cycle going.
But the computer adds it all up after a period of time. And they say, if we spend $50,000 promoting an artist and it doesn't come back, we might be better off spending $50,000 on, a rock group or a contemporary group. Because if they hit, the proceeds and the income is 10 times greater. No matter how much you make jazz records sell, it's a fellow like George Benson can make a hit record because he sings with it also, and it's really like a pop, like when Billy made pops, and some of the stuff Billy Joel sings are like pop, Billie Holiday derivative, but that's not jazz. Jazz has got almost a set audience. I think if you can sell 75 or 100,000, which is piddling in comparison to the figures you get on a contemporary group, and you keep your budget down based on the possibility of selling 50,000 records, the jazz records cost much less to make.
Oh, yeah.
You see.
Well, the rock records, you can spend 6 months in the studios producing one.
Yeah, right.
They
cost much less to make. Therefore, you can keep it under control. And do promote it and advertise it. Just don't let it sit on a shelf all by itself or have the artist peddle it in clubs. And you can probably double the sale of the jazz records, but it'll never be like a popular record.
You think so? Because in Europe it seems to be...
It's the same over there.
Really
I've been to Europe.
Music.
They work. What's good about it is the jazz people can work more. But they... You go over and listen to... I go over to record Bert Kempfert in West Germany, and he's got a lot of great jazzmen in that band, and he's a great arranger. And even so, when these people make... There are a lot of American musicians over there, and good British musicians, and Dutch musicians, and all. They make jazz recordings. And the big thing is when the Americans go on tour over there, they can be 70 years old, they'll do business.
Mm-hmm.
And because they want to see them. And they always were more appreciative about jazz there. You'll find old clubs still in business there. And but here, I know New York City has a lot of jazz people working now, which is very encouraging. But you're not going to talk about big numbers, and that's what the... major companies are interested in. So they will budget their jazz promotions. You can get killed taking full-page ads on record. It doesn't mean anything if you can't get it on the air.
Let's listen to another one of the sessions, another one of the Commodore sessions. This is from one of my favorites. This is Lester Young and the Kansas City Six.
Can I tell you
about
this?
Tell us what led to this session.
Our friend John Hammond had become a producer, a recording man for Vocalion, Brunswick. Well, he was doing Teddy and all. And he came into me one day, just like Billy came in. He had done a recording with what I call the Kansas City Five, with Buck Clayton and the rhythm from the Basie Orchestra and... who was the trombonist arranger? I'll have to look it up after the record, I'll tell you who it was. He cooked the little thing up, the backgrounds. First jazz electric guitarist, not Charlie Christian, the first, was the guy that put this together. And John came in and he said, they won't release it. They won't issue it. Would you pay them for the session and you put it out? So I know everything John did had to be done with taste and be good. And he said there were three sides. And I said, I'll take them without hearing them, John. Tell the company I'll buy the records. I said, but I can't use three sides. I have to have a coupling. But I tell you what I want to do. I want to add Lester Young on clarinet to the session because I love the way he played clarinet on the Basie recording of Blue and Sentimental. And with the light sound of this, that's what you call being a producer, right? The light, as even though I didn't know what I was doing, the light sound of that group couldn't take the heavy tenor, and Lester played light when he played tenor, but mostly I wanted to have him on clarinet. And this was my favorite side from that session. He played such beautiful clarinet on it. And it's called I Want a Little Girl, which was a Kansas City tune that Jimmy Rushin used to sing a lot. And let's play that.
Lester Young on clarinet, the Kansas City Six, recording of I Want a Little Girl. And the person who Milk Abler was referring to as the guitarist was Eddie Durham on that, who was featured on amplified guitar. How did it come to be that all these sidemen in the Basie band and the Basie's rhythm section were playing with Lester Young and Basie wasn't around?
Well, he was a Decca artist. You see, the band leader has an exclusive contract, and you can't record the leader of the band. So, in fact, I call one of the blues on this Countless Blues, but it didn't have piano on it at all. So it was a great session. It got great critical acclaim because it was like a Ceylon group. It was quiet, like a string quartet.
What was it like working with Lester Young?
Well, he was a gentle person. Never spoke much. He just played from the heart. I call him poetic. To me, on this record, when he plays pretty like this, and Pee Wee Russell plays pretty like this, there's a lot of similarity, and I'm the only one that ever says that. But I remember at Jimmy Ryan's on Sundays, when I'd have Pee-wee and Lester Young playing there, Lester Young on tenor, of course, that when he got off the stand, he would stand next to the drummer, because Pee-wee was playing in the front line. He loved Pee-wee Russell. And when he plays lower register and Pee-wee plays a pretty thing lower register, a lot of similarity. They both were poets of the on their instruments. And Pee-wee didn't really come into his own until years later when he started to play with musicians other than the Condon Gang. And he was really a sensational player, too.
Lester Young, apparently.
But Lester was a delight.
Yeah. What was it like to talk with him? From what I understand, I mean, his speech patterns were... he just had a really kind of very private, eccentric
language. Oh, he had one. I had
Noah
tell a story. I was doing a session with him once, and he said, let's go back to George Washington. And I didn't realize that, you know, you make a slow take because he had his own way of talking, and... He meant the bridge, the channel of the song. Let's go back to the bridge. And his mind was that way, and it was so funny. The guys all broke up.
<That's great. laughs> Let's move on to another tune. I want to be able to get to hear more. This is something with Mel Powell and Benny Goodman. You want to tell us about this session?
This was made in the early 40s when Mel Powell came into the store. Mel Powell kind of grew up at the Commodore. And he used to come in, and he was taking piano lessons at that time. He started when he was a young student to study classical music, but then he got interested in jazz, and he was taking lessons from Willie the Lion Smith, who was hanging around the store a lot at that time also. And one day Irving Kerlouden came in, and Jess Stacy was leaving the Goodman Band, and he said, who can I get on piano? And I said, I got a kid that comes in here that will just be fantastic. He knows every note Jess ever played, and he's a very competent young musician. And he said, who? I said, his name is Mel Powell. And he went over and he auditioned and he got the gig right away. And he was working with Benny and starting to do arranging for him. He did quite a few important arrangements for the Goodman Band. And he was cooking up a Commodore session for me to be done with members of the Goodman Orchestra. And they were running down The World is Waiting for the Sunrise during a five-minute break or so on a Goodman rehearsal time. And Benny heard the arrangement, and he came over and he started to play with them, to sit in and play with in Mel's arrangement, and he loved it. And he says, what is this for? Mel says, for Milt at the Commodore. And Benny said, I want to play it. I want to play on the record. And he was a Columbia artist. So I didn't dare do. Benny was such a big name. I didn't dare say, go ask Columbia for permission. I figured if Benny would take a chance to record for me, I'd go ahead and do the date. And sure enough, the day of the session came, and Benny came into the studio. I recorded this in Studio B at Decca, I remember. And he showed up, and I was tickled. Well, I had known Benny since he used to come into the Commodore and do studio work and pit band work. And he used to buy sporting goods from me and stuff like that. And we had a great rapport. And sure enough, he showed up for the date. And on the label, I was afraid that I couldn't say Benny Goodman Clarinet. I called him Shoeless John Jackson on the original Commodore label. And that became a very famous record because everyone knew who Shoeless John Jackson was the minute you heard the first bar of the clarinet. So let's play this. It's one of the great Commodore records, which I hope one day will wind up in the Record Academy Hall of Fame. Thank you.
Field is Waiting for the Sunrise, and we heard Mel Powell at the piano, Benny Goodman clarinet, and other of the Commodore sessions. It's been 30 or 40 years since you recorded many of the things that are going to be coming out again. How have they changed for you over time?
You mean the sound and
the
feeling?
The sound of it and the feeling of it, yeah.
You hear them. They're just as exciting to me. And, of course, I get a little catch and feel sad when I think that a lot of these fellows are gone and I'm still here. But by the same token, I still have the permanent record of the work they did. Mainstream, traditional, whatever you want to call it. If it's good, it's a delight to hear for the rest of your life.
Well, Mikhail Gibler, we really have you to thank for having these records now, for being able to listen to Lester Young and the Kansas City Six and Chu Berry recordings and Coleman Hawkins recordings. Thank you so much for all you've done for jazz, and thank you very much for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming down and joining us today and sharing so much with us.